From Hong Kong to the speech. Steve Walt has joined me in the studio. He's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University Kennedy School of Government. Connection listeners, we'd like to bring you into the program as well. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And also from the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board, Jim Woolsey, former director of the CIA, is on the line. I want to go back first to Bill Emmett in Hong Kong, because, Bill, we talked about what it was that the president needed to do in this speech at the United Nations. Did you hear him make the case that you think he needed to make?
I think he made about 90% of it, maybe 85-90%. I think he did a very good job of explaining how Saddam Hussein has violated United Nations resolutions historically, and what an extraordinary number of them he's violated. I think he did a very good job of positioning the problem of Iraq absolutely centrally within the United Nations, and how the attitude of Saddam Hussein is a defiant insult to the whole multilateralist idea, that if there's one terrible, arrogant unilateralist in the world, it is Saddam Hussein. I think he did a very good job at that. I think what was missing a little bit from the speech, understandably, but that now the administration...
We seem to have lost our line to Hong Kong. Bill, are you still there? No, we've lost the line to Hong Kong. We'll reconnect with Bill and pick up his thought there. Steve Walt here in the studio. Bill was just moving to what was missing, and it seems to me that there were a number of things missing from the speech.
Right. There were two sort of obvious things missing. One is he didn't detail any of the evidence behind some of the charges, the alleged close link between Iraq and terrorism. People have looked hard, for example, to find a link between al-Qaeda and Iraq. It just isn't there, despite lots of looking. He didn't detail any of that evidence. Even more important, however, is he didn't explain why going to war with Iraq is the proper solution. I think everyone around the world agrees that Saddam Hussein is an evil man, and everyone knows he's failed to live up to various international agreements. But the real question is, what's the best way to respond to that problem? The rest of the world has been saying that sanctions and containment is the right way to deal with it, and you wait for events to take their course and Saddam Hussein to die. The Bush administration has been saying, no, what we have to do is invade and get regime change. And he didn't explain why that option is the preferred option.
But he's making the case that it's the only option.
That's right. But he didn't say why it's the only option. He just says that's the option they prefer. For example, he didn't explain how an Iraq that did, if it did, manage to get weapons of mass destruction or manage to get nuclear weapons, he didn't explain why that Iraq would be likely to use nuclear weapons. He didn't explain why the United States could successfully deter the Soviet Union for 50 years, a far more powerful state ruled by equally odious dictators like Joseph Stalin. We could deter them quite easily. He didn't explain why suddenly Iraq is a much bigger threat that can't be deterred.
Jim Woolsey, you've spent a lot of time talking to opposition figures from Iraq. You know this story intimately. Did President Bush have to show something new, make some new case, present some new evidence at the UN in order to move closer to the resolution that he's looking for?
I don't think so particularly. I think the evidence is really has been here for a long time. It's just that we haven't done much about it. It's quite clear, I think, to anybody who looks into this, that Saddam has chemical and bacteriological weapons, and he certainly has a few, at least, ballistic missiles of longer range than he's permitted under the UN resolutions and the ceasefire, 150 kilometers, and he's clearly working on nuclear weapons. He's violating the ceasefire six ways from Sunday. And I think in terms of a legal rationale, one doesn't need any more than that. One doesn't need to get into preemption and the like.
So why, as Steve Walt is suggesting, is there still no compelling case, or why do you think there is a compelling case for the use of military action, if Steve's saying that he still doesn't see that or hear that?
Well, because the point is not, as Steve said, that or implied anyway, that we can solve this by waiting for Saddam to die. The Ba'athists seem into... clearly into hereditary dictatorship. That's what's happened in Syria. Saddam has two sons. One, Uday, kills people for fun. The other, Qusay, kills people in a very businesslike fashion. But we're not going to be any better off if Saddam has a heart attack tomorrow and we have Qusay and the Ba'athist structure and the same weapons of mass destruction programs and the rest. So I think waiting is not going to make this easier. It's going to make it harder. And also the point is not deterring Iraq from firing a nuclear weapon at someone. It is that once he has even more types of weapons of mass destruction than he has now, and once he has longer and longer range ballistic missiles, he's quite in a position, he or his successor, are quite in a position to dominate the Middle East and keep coalitions from hindering him in the sorts of things he's now tried to do twice, conquer Iran and conquer Kuwait.
We're hooked up with Hong Kong again, and Bill Emmett is on the line there. Bill is editor of The Economist magazine. Bill, I know you have to go. I'm just wondering, having heard the speech, having knowing what Bush has to do, where does it go from here, in your view?
Well, that is hard. It's a hard question to answer. I think that it will go to the Security Council. My guess is that the French and the Russians are willing to support a resolution in the Security Council to set an ultimatum for Saddam Hussein to allow in weapons of mass, weapons inspectors unconditionally and on an ultimatum, you know, of maybe just a couple of weeks to do that. I think the French and the Russians will have liked what they heard from George Bush. I think they will feel that he was playing the right multilateralist tune for them, and that they will have cover for their domestic political constituencies to support an effort through the United Nations to force Saddam Hussein to agree to what he's done. So I think that there will be that resolution. But then the basic ball will be in Saddam's court, and I think probably he will then try to pretend to agree to it. And there will be a period of trying to sort of expose the question of whether or not he's really agreeing to it. So I don't think the final answer is I don't think we're close to war yet. I think that we're going to go through a series of resolution, then some sort of crisis with Iraq, where Iraq tries to pretend that it's agreeing, and then the next question is America starting the war. America is going to build up its troops. I think there will be a continued effort to prove the credibility of this threat against Saddam, and I think that's a very good thing. And so it will build towards a crisis, I suspect not until late October or November.
Bill, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Very late in Hong Kong. We appreciate your staying with us. Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist magazine. Steve Walt from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, professor of international affairs. No deadlines, no specific timelines that were mooted beforehand. Lots of new pressure, but no deadlines.
I think that's right. There's a very long list of conditions here. I mean, the ending part of the speech really does read like an ultimatum that it's hard to imagine anyone being able to respond to, even if they wish to. And I frankly don't think some of the things that are in that ultimatum would be a sufficient justification for anyone to go along with us. The return of POWs is not something it's an important issue. It shouldn't be lost sight of, but it's not a reason to go to war. The president did mention what I think is the issue before us, the question of what long-term threat Iraq might pose, the issue of weapons of mass destruction, things like that. What really divides people here is not the question of, again, whether Saddam's a bad guy or whether he has done unpleasant things. It's whether that the United States is going to be better off, whether American national interests are going to be served in the longer term by going to war here. I think a resolution from the Security Council is likely to come out, although I think some of the one-sidedness of the Bush speech may not play particularly well. Again, at the end, that sort of it will either be done by the UN Security Council or we're going to do it may irritate some of the people who listened to it. And I think what Bill Emmett said is probably the most likely scenario. They'll get a resolution and then we'll enter a period of seeing just how well they comply.
Jim Woolsey, how much time is the president likely to give the UN to act?
I hope it's not much more than a few weeks. As I say, I think time is not on our side here. And I think there's an indication of what might happen in what happened over Kosovo in 1998. Milosevic was clearly killing Kosovars, and we went to the permanent members of the Security Council, and Russia was not going to permit any kind of resolution enforcing action. So we essentially said we're going to demand inspectors. The inspectors went in. Inspectors were, of course, thwarted by Milosevic. And 36 hours later, after notifying our fellow members of the Security Council, we started the bombing. And 70-some days later, Milosevic essentially capitulated. I think that if this is done promptly, and there is a set of conditions for disarmament, not just inspections, but disarmament, that would really be effective. It's true, there is no chance that a totalitarian ruler like Saddam will be able to accept them, but that's his problem, not ours. I think, for example, one condition that ought to exist is that anyone, the inspectors, if they go in, need to interview, must be able to be interviewed outside Iraq, and their family must be able to go with them.
Are you saying that the conditions that were outlined by Bush were conditions that were basically listed that everyone knew he wasn't going to meet?
Well, I think that it would be very hard for Saddam to meet some of them. What I'm saying is that I think there are more that would be necessary in order for inspections to be successful. If you're focusing on the inspections as distinct from the POWs and the other matters. One of the problems before was that the only way you know where some of these facilities, the 400 facilities for nuclear weapons, for example, that Kadir Hamza, Saddam's bomb maker, who came out in 94, says exist, one of the only places, ways you know where these things are is you have to talk to the people who are working on the program. And Saddam always before insisted that that conversation occur between the inspector and the person in the presence of an Iraqi intelligence officer. Well, of course, these people are afraid to say anything. So I think you have to be able to interview them outside Iraq, and you can't leave their families behind. Well, there are a number of things like that that are necessary in order for inspections really to be successful, and people will say, well, my gosh, Saddam will never agree to that. Well, okay, fine, but that is what is necessary, and the reason he can't agree to it is because he's a totalitarian fascist dictator.
Well, and that's actually quite revealing, because at several points in the speech, it was fairly clear that what the Bush administration is really seeking here is regime change in Iraq. Weapons of mass destruction is part of their concern. And it's worth noting that a couple of weeks ago, Vice President Cheney gave a speech to the veterans of foreign wars where he basically said sending inspectors back to Iraq wouldn't give us any assurances at all. So in a sense, it's a little bit disingenuous to point as much attention towards getting inspectors back in Iraq, getting Iraq to comply. It's fairly clear from the Bush speech what they want is Saddam Hussein out of power.
But what they want is people working with them on this, and if the price of it is asking for UN weapons inspections for the Canadians or the French to come on board.
That's right. But I think we see this as we are using an institution to try and accomplish something that we want to do, and that, again, brings us back to the question of is the world going to be better off if we fight a war in Iraq sometime in the foreseeable future.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. President George Bush has laid out his case before the UN General Assembly in terms of what it is that the U.S. expects of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein in terms of meeting UN resolutions, asking for weapons inspections, the destruction of missiles, and a list that we talked about a little bit earlier. Has the president in any way persuaded you that the case for some sort of military action against Iraq can be and will be made in the days and weeks ahead? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This day, we're looking at the speech of President George Bush made just moments ago, laying out his case against President Saddam Hussein in front of the General Assembly of the United Nations.
By his deceptions and by his cruelties, Saddam Hussein has made the case against himself.
With me in the studio, Steve Walt, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Joining us from Washington, Jim Woolsey, member of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board and former director of the CIA. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK, and we'll go straight to Appleton, Wisconsin, where Tammy's waiting on the line. Hi, Tammy.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I enjoyed the speech, and I actually think that I was informed more about Saddam's deceptions and how he's broken so many of the resolutions. I didn't realize when he listed it all out, it's like, wow, he hasn't really complied with anything. And the fact that the UN inspectors were kicked out and they've been out for 4 years, that just flies in the face of any authority that the UN has.
So Bush is saying to the UN, Tammy, you know, tighten up, get tough, get back in there.
Well, I really think that the inspectors back in there, it's like Saddam is a spoiled child that's been put in a timeout, his wrists have been slapped, he's been, maybe a privilege has been taken away with the sanctions. It's now time to drop his pants and use a hard wooden paddle and spank his rear. That's what it's time for, because he's a spoiled child, but it's in the political arena of he's a dictator of his country, and everything that they've laid out, he's just thumbed his nose at.
Okay, so next step, if the United Nations does what you're suggesting, and Saddam Hussein doesn't change the list of offenses outlined by President Bush, are you ready to see the men and women of Appleton, Wisconsin, heading off to the Gulf once again to war with Iraq?
I am. I may even join up with the reserves because, oops, there's my children. I have young children. It's just the fact that he's not going to comply. It doesn't seem like we've had any success with getting him to comply. Boys! I have two boys ready for the army. Stop fighting! I'm sorry about this. But anyway...
They're practicing.
They are practicing. I don't really have any doubt that he's not going to comply. So our president has come to the point where he says what he means and he means what he says, and it has to be a short time because we just cannot get anywhere with the sanctions and the slap on the wrist. And
well,
since
talk
September
to Tammy for a minute.
Yeah, I think unfortunately, running international politics is not like raising children. There might be some analogies there, but we don't want to push them too far.
No, more than we might care to count.
Yeah, Saddam Hussein is obviously a lot worse than a disobedient child. The question is whether or not going to war, putting American troops in harm's way, threatening the death of innocent Iraqi civilians, which would be an inevitable consequence of war, and then, most important of all, having the responsibility of governing a country that has been extremely difficult to govern in the past for an indefinite period is in the American national interest. The question is simply whether the threat Saddam Hussein poses to us is sufficiently grave to warrant that very, very large step. It's unfortunately not quite as simple as deciding how to put a child in time out.
I think Tally speaks for the vast majority of the American people, and I would suggest that we seriously consider having her be the next ambassador to the United Nations. I think that although Saddam is much worse than a misbehaving child, her approach and attitude toward behavior and common sense understanding of the situation is exactly right. There is no real chance that Saddam is going to comply with any reasonable set of requirements. And if you let him continue and do not move to rid the world of the Ba'athist regime, he will come in relatively short order to dominate the Middle East. And I think that the question is, how is this going to be easier next month or a year from now or 2 years from now than it is now? It's, I think, a relatively straightforward matter and very much the way she drew the analogy.
What about the critics who are saying, though, that if the United States were to go into Iraq, her preschoolers might be actually old enough to serve in the U.S. Army before the United States Army gets out of there?
Well, we would probably have to occupy Iraq for some time, hopefully together with allies in order to help nation build, yes, and to bring about decent government. But in terms of fighting the war itself, although you never want to take these things lightly, and we would, I think, want to have 100,000 to 200,000 troops in the region to make sure everything went well, keep in mind that after the air war last year, Saddam's million men under arms, nearly 900,000 of them in his regular units, decided pretty much the first day of the ground war between two courses of action. They either surrendered to Italian television film crews or they surrendered to American unmanned aerial vehicles. It's not that they didn't fight well. They didn't fight at all. The Republican Guard fought not especially well in a number of cases. The ground war lasted 100 hours. And during the air war, we were using 5% smart weapons. In Afghanistan, we were using about 50%. And then this war coming up that I think will occur, we're going to be using something like 80 to 85% smart weapons. I believe that the United States, together with the British and bases in the area, will be able to prevail in the war. There's a chance that Saddam may use weapons of mass destruction, and we have to take account of that. But if we're deterred from that now, we're going to be more deterred a month or two or three or four or five or a year or two or three from this point forward.
Yeah, I'll just say that that's partly why it's preposterous to argue that Iraq is ever going to dominate the Middle East. Israel itself is a far more powerful country, has 80 to 100 nuclear weapons of its own, and Iraqi military power, conventional and otherwise, is a pale shadow of what it used to be. There's no foreseeable future I can see where Iraq ever dominates the Middle East, regardless of what we do now.
I think that's absolutely dead wrong. With weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles of increasing range, I think he will be able to deter the forming of coalitions against him. In 1991, we came very close to losing the vote in the Senate, believing at the time, incorrectly, that he was not close to having weapons of mass destruction.
Jim,
we later found out he had nuclear weapons, or were close to having
them. Trying to get in on the program. I do want to open it up to callers. Tammy, thanks for your call to Nashville, Tennessee. Now, Jill's on the line. Hi, Jill.
Hi, I'm Jill Chambers. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for calling.
The reason I'm calling is because I do feel very strongly about this. I have two sons. They're 19 and 23. I come from an Army family. My father and two brothers went to West Point. My dad served in World War II. He served in Korea and Vietnam. There are wars that I would be willing for my sons to die in. I would never be willing for my sons to die in this.
Why?
Because I am convinced that Iraq is not the threat that one of your speakers thinks that it is. I do think it's preposterous to think that Iraq could be a threat to the Middle East. If Iraq made any kind of aggressive move, the whole world would stamp it out. And Iraq knows that.
What's missing, though, Jill? Is it a lack of evidence being presented by the administration? Is it a lack of an overall plan, an exit strategy? What is it that's missing in the case that the president's making?
Number one to me is the lack of evidence. And the second thing is that there's so many retired military officers that think this is absolutely crazy.
Jim Woolsey, you don't think it's absolutely crazy. Do you want to talk to Jill?
It's not crazy at all. I think there are analogies. For example, if you want to look at history, they're never perfect, but I think there's analogy to the situation in Europe in the mid-1930s. A lot of people were saying, rather than what Talley said, they're saying what Jill said, namely, this isn't serious enough. We don't need to do anything now. When Hitler first started violating the terms of the Versailles Treaty and moving into demilitarized region in the Rhineland in Germany, they said it wasn't serious enough. They said, let's wait. They waited 3 years, and it turned out they had a lot more to deal with than they bargained for. And Hitler's record in 1935-36 was not nearly as complete in terms of killing people and starting wars and the rest as Saddam's is today. I think it's just wishful thinking to believe that someone who has two types of weapons of mass destruction, has illegal ballistic missiles now, is working on nuclear weapons, is not going to use them to dominate a region. I think it's fantasy.
Jill, let me just ask you whether or not there isn't a little bit more to your objection here in terms of the case that the administration is making. Is it some part of you that bridles at the idea that the U.S. would be involved in any kind of preemptive strike, that the U.S. would be starting this war?
Yes, but the idea of a preemptive strike bothers me. I think an excellent book about what the personal cost of war is to families is Flags of Our Fathers. If you want to read what it's like for your sons and daughters now from different walks of life to go through military training and then die this time in an ocean, this time in a desert, but to die in huge numbers just trying to make it to the battleground. Mm. The waste of life needs to only occur if there's a clear and present danger.
Steve.
Yeah. And I don't think there's evidence for that.
Yeah, I want to make it clear. I think the use of force is sometimes justified. And I also believe that if we went to war with Iraq, we would eventually emerge victorious. But I don't believe the compelling rationale is there. There's this argument that Mr. Woolsey has advanced that if they had weapons of mass destruction or even nuclear weapons, that this would cast a huge shadow. Again, Israel has had nuclear weapons. That hasn't enabled them to dominate the Middle East. The Soviet Union had thousands of nuclear weapons, and we were able to form very powerful and cohesive alliances against the Soviet Union. If Iraq ever tried to seize territory from others again, I think we would be able to assemble a coalition just as we did in 1991, fighting a preventive war, which is what this is. This isn't a preemptive war. This is a preventive war against capabilities we're not even sure they have yet, is precisely why we're having such trouble getting international support. And just to add one final point, this is, I think, going to be a significant distraction from what should be our major concern now, which is dealing with international terrorism and dealing with Al-Qaeda.
I disagree on all counts. First of all, I don't see that this is essentially preemptive or preventive. This is enforcing a ceasefire, which he is clearly in violation of. From his point of view, the 1991 war never stopped, and he's behaving as if it never stopped. Secondly, I don't see where we get the notion that we're not sure that he has capabilities. I think anybody who looks at this ought to be clear that he has chemical and bacteriological weapons and ballistic missiles of longer than 150 kilometers, which he's permitted. It's not clear that he has yet nuclear weapons, but he's working hard on them. And if we have a hard time assembling a coalition now, what makes anybody think that after he has nuclear weapons and longer-range ballistic missiles, it's going to be easier? I just don't see the logic of that at all.
Isn't he most likely to use those weapons if we're coming to Baghdad?
But if you're deterred by that now, you'll be more deterred a year from now when the weapons are longer range and he more clearly has nuclear weapons and so on.
I wouldn't want to be invading Baghdad a year from now either. I don't want to have to govern Iraq for the next decade.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Thanks to Jill for your call to Baltimore, Maryland, and Phil's joining us now. Phil.
Just a very quick point. I don't think deterrence will work for a very different reason. I'm not as worried about what his directly threatening or attacking us. If you read the Atlantic Monthly last spring, there's a wonderful write-up on Saddam Hussein, and it says, like most small dictators, he's surrounded by a bunch of sycophants, people who are terrified of him and always tell him what he wants to hear. And because he's a small dictator, he does not have the airtight command and control that, say, the old Soviet Union would have going down below him. And if he was to develop nuclear weapons, the greatest danger is not that he would use them, it's that the know-how, the knowledge about those nuclear weapons would leak. Because he's a small dictator surrounded by people who are afraid of him and lie to him all the time, that the command and control is not a hermetically sealed system, and that that information could easily leak out into the rest of the Islamic world and eventually get to Al-Qaeda. It's not an unreasonable thought. In fact, it's the greatest threat that we face is that he can't control his information.
Phil has a good point.
It's also, unfortunately, a good point that would justify attempting to overthrow the government in Pakistan, where the problems are probably equally severe, and we know they already have nuclear capabilities.
But that's a relatively softer dictatorship, and I think the more freedom you have in a society, it's not perfect, but the more freedom you have in a society, the more checks and balances you have, and a better command and control system you'll have.
Phil, the administration is making the case, though, that they're not trying to preempt some kind of massive multi-warhead strike from Saddam Hussein, that one chemical weapon, one biological weapon, one loose nuke, dirty bomb or otherwise, is in large part what this is all about. And
that's a good point. I don't think he would ever attack us directly with any nuclear weapons. I'm afraid that if he developed the knowledge, which he's very close to completing the journey of getting the knowledge, if he developed the knowledge, I think he'd be afraid to use it at this point, but that it would leak out of his inferior command and control structure because he's a small dictator surrounded by people who lie to him. I think the knowledge would leak, and if it leaked and passed out into the Islamic world to someone like Osama bin Laden, that's what terrifies me.
Right. So is that a strong enough rationale in your mind to attack the country?
I think so. Just to put a stop to that whole weapons program, which he unfortunately hasn't been willing to cooperate with us and stop.
Phil has a very good point. The leakage of technology and systems and wherewithal of all sorts to terrorist groups is a good part of what this is about. He's right on the money.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Phil, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
To Dedham, Massachusetts now. Laura's on the line. Laura, go ahead.
Hi. I thought that the Bush administration thought that he had the technology. He doesn't have the enriched uranium, and I don't understand why Pakistan's nuclear capability isn't more of a threat, and I don't understand what the administration thinks will happen if Iraq, being invaded by the United States, attacks Israel. So I'm not really sure how they spin out what will happen in that region, and then
you're saying the problems from starting an attack are in your mind greater than the problems of not.
Well, I don't know, and I also am not certain that. I'm sorry. I also am not certain that that going back in with a lot of inspectors wouldn't at least provide quite a bit of control, even though obviously imperfect control.
You know, the inspectors didn't have a lot of luck in the 1990s when they were in there, Laura. I mean, Steve's shaking his head.
Yeah, that's not true. I mean, the UNSCOM was not perfect by any means, but it certainly found a great deal of stuff, destroyed a great deal of stockpiles, particularly in the first 4 or 5 years of its operation. It was quite an effective tool.
We don't know.
That's right. The point is you will never be 100% sure of any country you're allowed to inspect unless you've sort of turned over every rock in the place. That's never going to be happening. What you have to do is have a sufficiently intrusive inspection so you have high confidence that nothing of real significance has been hidden.
You need a stronger case, Laura. Is that what you're saying? Oh, she's gone. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we're taking a look at the details of President George Bush's speech to the United Nations this hour, asking you whether or not the case that he's making for tightening the screws, both at the UN level and failing that in a military way, is the policy that this government ought to follow. 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Within the last hour, President George Bush stood before heads of government and delegates to the General Assembly of the United Nations in New York City, making his case for a regime change in Iraq. Not a word that you hear that much these days from the administration, but it's there, it's on the record, and nobody's backing away from it, as well as it being a challenge to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, though it was also a challenge to the United Nations. George Bush saying, will the United Nations serve the purpose of its founding, or will it be irrelevant?
We cannot stand by and do nothing while dangers gather. We must stand up for our security and for the permanent rights and the hopes of mankind. By heritage and by choice, the United States of America will make that stand. And delegates to the United Nations, you have the power to make that stand as well.
1-800-423-8255 to join us on the program today. With me from Washington, Jim Woolsey, former director of the CIA, a member of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board, and in the studio here in Boston, Steve Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. From Burlington, South Carolina, who's been holding for a long time, and William, I thank you for your patience. William.
Yes, it's North Carolina, but that's okay. We're close enough down here in the provinces. I have to ask the question, watching all of this go on, why is the entire media, including the much-revered chattering class, involved in this so deeply? why is this suddenly such an absolute crisis that has to be solved now? And will we wake up in November to find out that, oh, gee whiz, containment was good enough anyway? So I don't know if you ever saw the story of
Wait a second here, William. I mean, this matters to you. You've been holding on the line for a long time.
Yes, it does. I'm saying that this is wag the dog. Who benefits? The only person I can see is George Bush.
What's the benefit that you see he gets out of this?
The midterm elections of the 2004 election.
So it's all about domestic policy?
I think it's diversion from domestic issues. I mean, let's face it. You know, you have 45 million people without health insurance. You've got an environmentally insensitive, if not hostile, administration. You've got a growing deficit. You've got corporate corruption like we haven't seen in since probably 29 or 30. And we don't hear anything about it because, Mr. Gordon, you are, and all of your friends are tied up talking about the theoreticals about Iraq. Now, whether we solve the Iraq problem today or even next year, I sincerely doubt that much is going to change. Tighten it up and make the cordon sanitaire work even better if you can, and just don't go get a bunch of people killed. It worries me that the chicken hawks, and a chicken hawk is a hawk that wants to go to war, but he's never been there. He wants everybody else's kid to go get killed.
But if several hundred thousand American men and women are asked to get on the aircraft carriers and go to the Gulf...
Well, they probably will. Unfortunately, they will have been led into it. I suspect there are other solutions to the problem, but right now I think that this is being driven much more. And, you know, this came out. Karl Rove's even admitted that they're driving the war drum strategy to affect the midterm and presidential elections.
Jim Woolsey, it's all about politics, domestic politics.
Oh, it's utter nonsense.
Well, that's easy for you to say. You're part of the chattering class, sir.
I practiced law for a living here for a number of years. I served in the military, and, sir, I think you've insulted the president, and I think you're flat wrong. I'm a Democrat, but I believe that the president is behaving in the best traditions of American presidents and trying to protect the country. There are legitimate policy issues on some of these matters that you mentioned, in which I probably agree with you more than I do the administration. But I think to impugn his and people like Colin Powell's and Dick Cheney's and Don Rumsfeld's patriotism by saying that they're only doing this in order to enhance their party's future in the elections this fall is despicable.
Though proposed military action is the sort of subject in this country that gets people pretty hepped up, and I'm wondering whether or not, Jim, you don't acknowledge that there's going to be a certain edge to this debate expressed by you know, the cynicism or the anger of William's call that's going to come over the next few weeks.
Well, I think that your earlier caller, Tally from Appleton, Wisconsin, is far more indicative of the people of the United States out there than this effective, I don't know what to call it, verging on slander of the president. I just think that is a despicable way to try to conduct a debate on matters of important public policy. One ought to focus on the substance, on the issues, on whether the Saddam's going to be deterred or can be deterred, the sort of things that Steve has been addressing. He and I see this differently, but we've been addressing the issues. The caller decided and said instead to turn to ad hominem arguments and insult the president, and I think it's ridiculous.
William, joining us from Burlington, North Carolina, thanks for your call. To Louisville, Kentucky now, Paul's on the line. Paul.
Hang on, Brian.
Paul?
Hey, yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, listen. Unlike your last caller, that apparently is totally off base, I spent 6 months and 4 days in the Gulf defending this country for people like that, and I can't believe it. We accomplished our mission, which was to free the Kuwaiti people, okay? I spent 32 days 6 miles from Basra and wished we could go in there and take care of Saddam Hussein then, and I swore then that we would do it someday, and now we're going to do it, and everybody's scared. Well, I got news for them. People don't volunteer to be in the United States Army, or any service for that matter, if they're scared.
Paul, it's been more than 10 years since that time. I'm wondering how you see the attitude of the nation changing, though, that you'll get extremes of opinions like yours and Williams.
Well, I'm really sorry about my extreme opinion.
I didn't call it an extreme. I'm sorry, I meant, you know, opposite ends. I don't mean your opinion's extreme. I just mean it's an extremely long way from William.
Well, he apparently has no pride in his country. And he apparently has no pride in his president. And we all heard that just now.
Yeah.
I support President Bush. I support the entire nation. My flag flies in front of my house 24 hours a day, every day.
Paul, hang on the line. I want to let Steve Walt in here.
Yeah, I think the caller is expressing something that we ought to bear in mind. The American military is deeply patriotic and also deeply obedient. It's also clear that there's a lot of skepticism within the officer corps about whether or not going to war with Iraq is in the best interest of the country. And it's also worth noting that President Bush's father, the first President Bush, and his advisors, including former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft and some others, think this is a bad idea as well. Well, we didn't go to Baghdad in 1990-91 because we realized then that we would be causing more problems than we would be solving. And Saddam Hussein was just as bad a guy and just as aggressive. So, again, I'm not questioning patriotism. I'm not questioning whether the American military would follow orders and do this. What I've been questioning is whether or not this is the best way to deal with this particular problem.
Paul, are you still there? Oh, he's left us. Okay. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to Raleigh, North Carolina now. Roger's on the line. Roger.
Yes, I'd like to return to this metaphor of the family that the earlier caller brought up.
Saddam Hussein is a spoiled child?
Yes, and that he needs to be paddled, and I thought it was rather ironic that she then spoke to her children in the background, you know, stop fighting! Because I think, I'm not sure of the numbers, but many Americans have come on a more enlightened view that you do not create a peaceful household by hitting your child to teach that hitting is wrong. Now, that's not to say that there's no place for force in world politics.
What do you think the United States should do in or about Iraq at this point?
Well, I think that we're at a crossroads and that Bush, who has not even really acknowledged the accountability to Congress in the power to make war, seems to be going this way. And really, I wouldn't blame other people in the world for feeling threatened that he is the one that is taking this course.
Bush has said that he'll go to Congress, though, Paul. Roger.
What's that?
Bush has said that he will go to Congress. He's not said specifically that he will seek congressional approval or a declaration of war, but he's going to consult.
Well, there's an awful lot of signs that that's not really happening or going to happen. The way I think it should be dealt with is that we should be having a regional discussion about the grievances. I would have liked to have heard right after Bush the discussion from other side about other UN sanctions or resolutions that have not been so pro-U.S. and anti-Saddam, because then I think we could work towards a win-win solution. If we had a discussion, if we weren't taking this kind of big stick, go-it-alone approach, which then we could be looking at alternative energy technologies. U.S. could be a leader. And Jill, you know, I feel like my family's security is being threatened, even though, you know, I don't have anybody that's in the military. I have a son, but I feel that the course that they're taking is making it just far more likely that there will be more mad people, you know, desperados that are going to likely to do more and more terrorist acts. And I think the quicker that the American people wake up and show the pride in our country by exercising their democratic rights to take a more positive role in the world, the better. I was just going to say that in Japan we kicked ourselves. I mean, you know, that the Japanese got all this.
Roger, I want to let you go because I want to have a little bit of time to wrap up with my guest and thank you for your call. And one of the things that Roger talked about, Steve Walt, was regional implications of this. He was talking about seeing the policy in context of other policies, but one of the features of where what happens next is what happens in the Gulf region, in the Mideast, as a result of this. The warnings have been dire on both sides.
Right. The concern I think most of us would have is that if you go in to Iraq and tear the place apart, which is what we would essentially be doing, you create a situation of considerable instability both in Iraq and possibly in some of the neighbors. There are implications for the Kurdish populations in Turkey, as well as in Iraq, who may make a bid for independence. We would be creating, in a sense, a failed state. There's no effective civil society in Iraq. Saddam Hussein has eliminated that. It would be Afghanistan of a sort, which is already proving as difficult to govern as we anticipated it would be. In a sense, having warned us against the danger of failed states, we would be in the process of creating a failed state. And I think if we choose this option, we have to do it with our eyes open that we are likely to be there for years, if not decades. And the American presence there, even if we are greeted initially as liberators, which again is not certain to me, but it's conceivable, the longer we stay there, the more resentment we're likely to provoke in exactly the way we're seeing resentment provoked elsewhere. We ought to ask ourselves seriously if that's something we want to take on.
Jim Woolsey, are these implications, these questions, part of the conversation?
I think Steve's wrong on all points. I think we're not going to tear Iraq apart. There's no reason to target the infrastructure of the state. One targets Saddam with 85% smart weapons. One can target the instruments of power of the state, such as the Republican Guard and Saddam's commandos and the like. Bernard Lewis, who I think is our greatest national authority on the Mideast, says that Iraq is quite contrary to what Steve says, says that Iraq is the Arab country that's probably best suited to democracy. Not only is it unlikely to fly apart, but it has an educated population. It's had 40 years of totalitarian dictatorship and a great deal of appetite for freedom. And it has the second largest oil reserves in the world. So it, once it can pump oil, it'll be reasonably wealthy. I think that this is not a simple matter. One can't assume everything is going to work out ideally. One has to assume we're going to have to be there and help and be involved in nation building and use the 20% of the Iraqis who are outside the country, and many of whom favor freedom, to help rebuild the country. But I think this kind of pessimism is just completely unwarranted.
Well, the debate is certain to continue for some time. Jim Woolsey, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
Jim Woolsey, member of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board, director of the CIA from 1993 to 1995. Steve Walt, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Steve is professor of international relations at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Earlier in the program, we talked to Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist magazine. Constance Stelzenmüller was here. She's defense and security editor of the German Newsweek Weekly, Die Zeit, and Mustafa El Said, political science professor at Cairo University. Also, Judy Keene set the whole thing up for us. She's White House correspondent for USA Today. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue this conversation on our forums online. We're at www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.